The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone. The views and opinions expressed are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but if God really wants us to serve and obey him, why has he done such a dismal job of making himself known? Actually, the evidence for the existence of God is overwhelming, and not just some kind of generic God, the actual God of the Bible. Now, 2 weeks ago, I began a talk about Daniel chapter 9, in which Daniel gave an exact prophetic calendar of when Jesus Christ would ride into Jerusalem. We will continue this interesting discussion later on in today's program, a lot to discuss in the news, but I'm going to start this afternoon with something light and unimportant. More correctly put, it is seemingly light and seemingly unimportant. I'm going to talk about punctuality. That's right, you heard me correctly, punctuality. Now, everybody has friends. Some of them are always on time. One member of my Bible study on Monday nights is so predictably punctual. If he's not there by 7 o'clock on the dot, we know he will not be able to make it at all that evening. Others, you know this, we all know this, others can be counted on to be tardy to every single solitary event. I was a campus minister for some 20 years, which accounts for many of my human behavior observations. I'll never forget the time I surprised my parishioners with an entire sermon on punctuality. Oh, it was fun to watch the looks on their faces when I did not ask them to turn to Romans or Galatians. To assure the startled group that my subject matter was more important than one might think, I reminded them, a group of young marrieds, mostly, many of whom had me officiate at their weddings, how important their wedding day was. I said to them, next to the day you gave your life to Christ, that was the most important day of your life, and many of your dearest friends missed most, if not all, of the ceremony because they couldn't drag their bones out of the house on time. How did that make you feel? Or how many Bible studies and meetings are interrupted by somes who roll in any old time, disrupting the teaching by turning to somebody immediately, asking what they missed or what chapter we're on? That's what I said to my congregation. Now, I know that not everybody who listens to this program is religious, and I respect that. So if you are not a Christian, indeed, if you are not religious at all, I have no desire to leave you out. Have you noticed that when you go to a movie, somebody always comes in late? Generally speaking, the later they are, the noisier they are. You're trying to watch the movie while some yutz mumbles, bumbles, and stumbles his way in, or some mother tries to quiet her children as they look for a seat. Excuse me. Now, before I continue, yes, I'm aware that one can never control every circumstance. So naturally, there are times when all of us are late. I've been late. I've been late many times. I'm talking only about those who make it a habit. Frankly, I don't even consider it a problem when the person is late by only 5 or 10 minutes. Unfortunately, the lapsed time is usually a great deal longer. I mean, who are we kidding? Making people wait shows inconsiderateness at the very least and causes terrific inconvenience at the very most. I did campus ministry for 5 years in Santa Barbara. Several times a year, we went away on weekend retreats. Students would meet at our host church where we would all get on a bus together. Many of the students were consistently a whole hour late for the rendezvous. As the years went by, I decided to be strategic. I announced that we were departing an hour earlier than we really needed to leave. If I felt we had to be on the road by 4 o'clock, I told people to meet at the church at 3 o'clock. Pretty smart, huh? Not really. The whole thing backfired in my face. Sooner or later, word began to spread. Hey, when Bob says 3 o'clock, that means we aren't really leaving until 4 o'clock. So I'll just get there at 4 o'clock. But because this was a person who always ran an hour late, it meant he arrived at 5 o'clock. Meanwhile, our newest students showed up at 3 o'clock. Dumb kids. They just didn't know any better. They figured that if I said 3 o'clock, we were going to leave at 3 o'clock. What did they know? Now they had to wait around 2 hours until five. I realize that people do not get out of bed, look themselves in the mirror, and say, I think I'll be late for all important events. True, one might make it a point to be fashionably late at a party, but with important commitments, nobody is going out of their way to make a poor showing. With this in mind, I want to suggest that as human beings, we are creatures of habit, and we can just as easily develop good habits. The only reason we don't is that we are telling ourselves we can't. During this same era of campus ministry in Santa Barbara, one of my assistant staff, paid assistant staff, was always showing up 15 minutes late for our meeting. Now, okay, 15 minutes is not as bad as an hour, but since he was a leader and since he was an example, in this particular case, I felt I needed to broach the subject with him. And I said to him one day, would you say you are disciplined or undisciplined where punctuality is concerned? Well, he kind of figured that was a loaded question, which naturally it was. He says, well, I guess you're going to tell me that I'm undisciplined. I says, no, not at all. As a matter of fact, you are very disciplined. You show up at our meetings exactly 15 minutes late every single week. It takes discipline to show up at the same time on all occasions. What you need to do is harness this same discipline and be there on time. If you can make it by 7:15, you can just as easily make it by 7 o'clock. All right, maybe not the most important subject in the world, but it is important. Somebody had to say something. May as well be me. On to the news. A fresh round of United Nations resolutions against Iran's nuclear activity have been issued. Iranian President Ahmadinejad called the resolutions a mere annoyance. Folks, God forbid that I should find myself in agreement with this evil snake of a dictator, but for once in his miserable life, he finally spoke the truth. The phrase mere annoyance is about as correct a description of the United Nations effectiveness as I have ever heard. The day that flea-bitten pest hole of an organization closes down, I, for one, will throw a party. A party. There'll be cake and ice cream and soda pop. And this excuse to celebrate, I fear, will be the only value history ever records of the United Nations. History also recorded an election last week, very important election. Elizabeth Vargas of ABC News had some commentary about this election, but specifically, she wanted to talk about the strong showing of female Republican candidates. They just aced this thing. Now, wait till you hear whom she attributed the success to. None other than Hillary Rodham Clinton. Hillary's candidacy in the 2008 election paved the way, after all. Yeah, sure, that's what happened. I was wondering how people like Carly Fiorina, Nikki Haley, and Meg Whitman did so well. Let's all extend a heartfelt thanks to Elizabeth Vargas for explaining it to us. Yes, I can just picture this. Republicans going to the polls last Tuesday thought back fondly to 2008. They pushed for strong Republican women with conservative values out of respect for Hillary Clinton. After all, no other female was in the race that year. Neither is that same woman busy these days endorsing candidates who are winning elections. How will they spin this stuff after November when Republicans more than likely take back the House and the Senate? Oh, this is how they'll do it. Well, you see, Democrats are getting in the way of Obama's desire to reform Washington. And that's why we had to switch parties and promote some bipartisanship. Does that sound nutty? Well, that is exactly how Senator Scott Brown's victory was explained. Dream on, Democrats. Keep dreaming all the way through November. I have a feeling that this year, Thanksgiving will offer far more than stuffing and cranberry sauce to be grateful for. But Spain gives us little to be grateful for. Madrid, Spain banned Israel from participating in their gay pride parade out of protest over the Gaza flotilla raid. Now, I'm not a believer in gay pride parades anyway. Be that as it may, a few pertinent facts are called for in order to set the record straight. No pun intended. First of all, these ships were intercepted because they were carrying weapons bent on the destruction of Israel. Second of all, do you realize that in Gaza, they were intercepting the ship because they were bringing supplies into Gaza? Did you know that in Gaza, They execute homosexuals. Yeah, they just kill them. Now, I'm not sure much more needs to be said, except that in Israel, homosexuals are given the exact same legal standing as all other citizens. In the name of human rights, I guess the Gay Pride Parade forgot their own cause for a moment. Anti-Semitism will do that to people. Of course, this week's anti-Semite prize really ought to go to Helen Thomas. Now, she's actually been in the news for a couple of weeks. There's been so much going on with her, and the story grows and morphs and changes every day. So what I'm going to do is back up to the beginning. I'm reading from Fox News from a couple of weeks ago. Fox News, June 4th, 2010, says this, just in case you've been on another planet, you haven't been following this story. Veteran White House reporter Helen Thomas has issued an apology after saying in an interview that Jews should get the hell out of Palestine. Thomas, a longtime White House correspondent who now writes a column for Hearst Newspapers, made the comments May 27th after a White House Jewish heritage event. Asked by Rabbi David Nesoff if she had any comments on Israel, Thomas replied, "Tell them to get the hell out of Palestine." Thomas went on to say that the Palestinian people are occupied and it's their land and that Israelis should go home to Poland, Germany, America, and everywhere else. In a written statement issued Friday, Thomas apologized, saying, "I deeply regret my comments I made last week regarding the Israelis and the Palestinian." She said the comments do not reflect her heartfelt belief that peace will come to the Middle East only when all parties recognize the need for mutual respect and tolerance. Yeah, she sounded very respectful and tolerant of Israel, didn't she? "May that day come soon," she added. Okay, commentary time with your old pal Bob. Gosh, where do I begin? Well, to start with, Helen, there is no occupation of Palestine. In fact, there is no such country as Palestine, and there never has been. This land belonged to the Jews many thousands of years before you were even born. After the Romans conquered Israel and squashed a Jewish rebellion, Emperor Hadrian renamed the land Palestine. It was a Latinization of the ancient word Philistine, the old enemy of Israel. Hadrian did this to rub the Jews' face into a deliberate insult. The people we currently refer to as Palestinians never even called themselves by such a name until the 1960s and even more in the 1970s. It was a publicity ploy by the terrorist Yasser Arafat, who realized he could never win a military battle with Israel and instead chose to wage a PR war instead. He won that war, hands down. The people in the land who now call themselves Palestinians are actually Arabs. Now, although Arabs have lived in this area for 1,400 years, the Jews were there first, and Arabs arrived as a result of Muslim military expansion. They're not known in that land in significant portions until after Muhammad in the 600s. Be that as it may, the Jews still agreed to give the Arabs half of the land as part of a United Nations partition. The Arabs refused, calling instead for the complete annihilation of Israel. Israel was attacked by five invading nations who asked the Palestinian Arabs to join them. Jews pleaded with Palestinian Arabs to remain in their homes. Although many of the Arabs did flee or join the invading armies, a considerable portion of the Arabs remained in Israel. This interesting fact is seldom discussed. About 300,000 Arabs fled Israel, and about 160,000 Arabs remained in Israel. Today, Israel contains a vital Arab population, and these Arabs have more rights in Israel than any other Arab in any Arab country. In fact, shortly before Yasser Arafat's death, when there was talk once again under the Bush administration of a separate Palestinian state, the Arab citizens in Israel were asked if they wanted to move, renounce their Israeli citizenship, and live in the Palestine sector. Guess what they decided? Some of them probably fell on the floor laughing before saying to the Israeli government, Oh, I'm sorry, you were serious. In 1948, when Israel beat the odds and defeated five invading nations, the problem of refugees came up. We always hear about the Arab refugees as the result of a war, but they were not the only refugees. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were kicked out of Arab lands as well. All of the Jewish refugees were welcomed into Israel, whereas Arabs who wanted to resettle in Arab countries were, for the most part, denied admission. Jordan was an exception, but even in Jordan, most of the refugees were confined to camps. They lived in that condition all the way up to 1967 when Israel annexed Jordan's West Bank. Prior to 1967, there was no significant ongoing discussion amongst the countries of the world regarding Jordan's treatment of the poor Palestinians. And so, Helen, you really should bone up on your history and your geography before making these embarrassing public comments. If you must talk about land, Helen, maybe the Grand Canyon would serve as a better subject. It may just be the only thing bigger than your mouth. More about Helen Thomas in Israel when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. To build your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. We've been talking about Helen Thomas's infamous comments about Israel, and we actually have the audio clip. Let's go ahead and play that clip right now.
Any comments on Israel? We're arresting everybody today. Any comments?
Tell them
on
to
Israel?
Get the hell out of Palestine.
Ooh. Any better comments?
Helen is one.
Remember, these people are occupied, and it's their land, not German, it's not Poland.
So where should they go? What should they do?
Go home.
Where's the home?
Poland.
So the Jews,
Germany.
Wow. Well, much has happened since these initial comments. Even White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs called Helen Thomas's words reprehensible. Shortly after, by an amazing coincidence, Miss Thomas announced her retirement. I am going to miss Helen. And if you believe that, you'll love what I have to tell you about Santa Claus. The resignation is no surprise. Many were calling for the resignation of her, as well they should. I don't think she should be fired because I'm a believer in free speech, no matter how bad the free speech is. But for her to have the decency to step down after a comment like that, that is another story. She should step down for her thoughtless, ignorant, anti-Semitic sounding remarks. But lest we come down too hard on poor Helen, who is almost 90 and perhaps finding it more difficult to conceal the true thoughts that have inhabited her heart for years, keep in mind that her viewpoint is awfully close to our president's. Any man who would refer to Jerusalem, the capital of the Jewish homeland for thousands of years, as occupied territory does not display even a kindergarten understanding of the Middle East. Helen is an annoyance at best. Obama is a threat to the security of our only true ally in a turbulent region of the world that hates America almost as much as it hates Israel. Meanwhile, Helen does have a defender. Relax, Helen, the cavalry has arrived in the form of Rosie O'Donnell. Now, Rosie O'Donnell defending Helen Thomas can be likened to President Obama's proof that he did not try to bribe Representative Joe Sestak because the courier of his offer was none other than that paragon of truth and virtue, Bill Clinton. Unfortunately for Helen Thomas's rescue, Rosie's loose cannon mouth has a reputation of its own. I'm reading now from Pulse Media, June 11th. Rosie O'Donnell defended Helen Thomas Wednesday on her radio show, arguing that Thomas's comments about Israel were not as offensive as the reaction to them suggested. Thomas retired after her legendary career as a White House correspondent after a firestorm over her comments that Israel should get the hell out of Palestine and that Jews in Israel should return to Germany, Poland, or the U.S. Now, I think in the year 2010, what she was saying was not go back to the ovens, O'Donnell said of Thomas's comments. What she was saying was the homeland was originally Palestinians, and it's now occupied by Israel, and Palestinians should be afforded human and civil rights. That's what I think she was saying, but I don't know. Well, Rosie, you got the last part of your statement correct. You don't know. Rosie, offensive as places like Germany and Poland might sound to people who survived the Holocaust, I am with you in doubting that Helen Thomas wanted Jews to go back to the ovens. But you are also defending her drivel about how Palestinians lived in the land first and are presently occupied by Israel. So I mentioned this already. Let me say it again, because I don't think we can say it too many times today, and I don't think enough people are listening. The Jews have inhabited that land for thousands of years, and there has never been a country called Palestine. The people currently calling themselves Palestinians, once again, are Arabs, and Arabs never arrived in the Holy Land until after Muslim jihad expansion. They live under Israeli occupation only because they cooperated with five different Arab countries attempting to annihilate Israel. And Israel's gestures since then toward a separate state have been rewarded with nothing but terrorist attacks. Ever since the independence of Gaza, remember, Israel did pull out of Gaza. What happened since then? Thousands of missiles fired into Israel almost every single day after they pulled out. That's what happened. The peaceful Palestinians do not believe in a two-state solution. Their understanding of sharing the land is that Arabs can live on the surface and dead, buried Jews may live below. That's how they want to share the land. And so, unfortunately, Helen Thomas's ignorance of the Middle East is only being amplified by somebody every bit as ignorant. If we could get her to expand the subjects a bit, I wonder if we might hear these other defenses from Rosie O'Donnell. Rosie O'Donnell on the Civil War. The poor southern states were illegally occupied by the Union simply because the Union had to impose their own morality on matters like slavery, which, after all, had been settled by that landmark Supreme Court decision, Dred Scott. Or how about Rosie O'Donnell on Spartacus? The evil rebellion of Spartacus caused the death of many Roman citizens because he could not bring himself to cooperate with a harmless sport like gladiator games. Or how about Rosie O'Donnell on the original Exodus? The evil Hebrews are responsible for 10 plagues that almost wiped out the peaceful Egyptians simply because Pharaoh did not want to release Joseph's children from the Egyptian Workers' Union, and we all know how sacred a workers' union is. Speaking of the sacred, Comedy Central's controversial decision to feature a weekly cartoon show about Jesus Christ continues to make news. The show is entitled J.C., J.C. I wonder how many hours around the board table it took to come up with that name. One can almost faint in the light of such brilliance and sheer genius. Now, I've been asked by many for my viewpoint on this as a Christian. Allow me to be as simple and as clear as I possibly can. I could care less if they want to do a cartoon about Jesus. It does not affect my faith even an iota. The issue for me is one of consistency. When South Park featured a cartoon adaptation of Muhammad, Comedy Central caved into vicious Muslim threats and censored the episode. If somebody wanted to be honest over there, admit their cowardice, and say, I guess this religion called Christianity, which we seem to enjoy ridiculing, is not such a bad religion after all. We certainly do not worry that Christians will put a jihad out on Comedy Central. If they wanted to say something like that, then perhaps we could cut Comedy Central some slack. Instead, I'm sure we'll be treated to comments about how tasteful their new Jesus cartoon will be. They might even include some moralizing in which Jesus teaches that all religions are equal because all men are brothers who should join hands to sing Kumbaya. You know, accurate New Testament theology. Actually, I have a better idea. How about a cartoon that features the hypocrisy of Comedy Central executives? We can call it HC. Hey. Have you seen the gleam in Obama's eye lately? This oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, I'm telling you, it's the best thing that could have happened to him. True, he's under a lot of criticism for not responding to the disaster fast enough, but that will soon be eclipsed by his cherished excuse to eliminate offshore oil drilling completely and nationalize the oil industry. If he does not completely and totally nationalize the companies, we will at least see something very close. Just as our financial meltdown gave the Democrats an excuse to spend more, not less, Obama now sees another emergency to exploit. He loves it. He salivates at the chance of Americans watching tar-trapped ducks and turtles, as several members of his own cabinet have explained more than once now. Never let a good crisis go to waste. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785, that's 447-8785, for W&S Electric, Incorporated, license number 480-539, W&S Electric.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
I mentioned before we went to the break that this oil spill is really the best thing that could happen to Obama because it's giving him an excuse to nationalize the oil industry and cut off a lot of offshore oil drilling. And here's the sweetest part. After he takes over the oil industry, he'll give a speech on television the next day about how he doesn't really believe in big government. But due to the mess George Bush left us, he had no choice. Speaking of Bush, well, it was only a matter of time. In an interview with Don Imus, Senator Chris Dodd blamed the BP oil spill on, you guessed it, George W. Bush. If not for Bush's permissive regulations of the past, the accident never would have happened. The fact that environmental concerns are making people drill in mile-deep water instead of closer to the coast couldn't possibly have had anything to do with an accident. Look, if Dodd wanted to merely claim this wasn't Obama's fault, I would be with him. I would say, President Obama, welcome to the world of being blamed for everything on Earth, including the weather. But he just couldn't resist playing the George Bush card. So he drags Bush out of the closet again, even though he has not been our president for a year and a half. In any event, since we're on a roll, here is a list of other things to blame on good old George W. Bush. You see, I like to help my fellow Democrats out once in a while. When our banks or department stores are robbed at gunpoint, that is only because the failing economy breeds desperate measures, and who ruined our economy more than George Bush? When terrorists attack, it is only because George Bush was unwilling to call them terrorists. That insulted the poor guys. They wanted to be known as philanthropists. Had Bush refrained from using the term, as Obama plans to now do, we would get along so well with Al-Qaeda and Hamas, we'd all take a house by the sea together. And Bush is responsible for Simon Cowell leaving American Idol. If not for the homophobic environment created by our former president, Simon would not have minded working another year with Ellen. And when your Slurpee at 7-Eleven melts too quickly, that is due to global warming brought about by the loose emission standards on big auto industries who were in bed with George Bush. When your car gets a flat tire, it is the fault of George Bush. You see, tires are made of rubber, and rubber comes from trees, trees that Bush had no business cutting down. Had your tire been made with a different substance, it never would have gone flat. When a cat eats a bird, it's not because the cat is hungry. After all, there's that bowl of Purina waiting for her in your kitchen. No, it's only because times are tough, and the poor feline feels disillusioned, and who let her down more than George Bush, hmm? Didn't he use the word mankind in a speech once, leaving out the entire animal kingdom and making them feel like second-class citizens? Well, that's what cats do when they feel like second-class citizens. They eat birds. If you didn't know that, then you are uneducated. You know who else was uneducated? George Bush. Oh, what? You say he graduated Yale? Well, yeah, sure, if you're going to bring up that one. And then, if you get too fat from eating fast food, it is only because you ordered the Happy Meal. And why did you order the Happy Meal? To cheer yourself up, to make yourself happy. You wanted to become happy because you weren't happy. And you weren't happy because Bush was your president for 8 years. Even to this day, you still have not gotten over it. One more. Bush was responsible for the bubonic plague, the Ice Age, which was far too cold, and the melting of the Ice Age, which was far too hot. How could he have done this when such phenomenon happened before he was even born? We don't know yet, but we're working on it. And yet, there's even bigger news than George Bush. Ask Greta Van Susteren. Her news stories are always so important. Now, I got to tell you something about Greta. Although a very able news commentator and certainly an intelligent woman, Greta Van Susteren has disappointed me in the past by focusing on sensationalist news stories. From Scott Peterson to Anna Nicole Smith to Natalie Holloway, On the Record with Greta Van Susteren tends to feature matters that are certainly important to grieving families, but not really news for the rest of us. I'm going to say this delicately. Sadly, there are murders every day. To pick one or two and highlight them with talking head commentaries day after day, even when there is absolutely nothing new to report, is shameless tabloid journalism. Between the war on terror, the attempts of our current administration to silence free speech, the failing economy, and the Marxist direction of America, one would think that a 24-hour news network would find more important things to discuss. For a while, it looked like Greta was doing just that, returning to real news, and then it happened. Jeroen van der Sloot, chief suspect but unproven murderer of Natalie Holloway, was arrested again in relation to a new killing. Well, Greta, I guess it was fun while it lasted. I enjoyed hearing you talk about health care or interviewing people like Sarah Palin or grilling politicians who fudged on questions. Now I'm going to have to stomach the name van der Sloot again for the next 8 months. I had hoped I'd never have to hear his stupid name again. Honestly, when the Battle of Armageddon begins and Christ's second coming is on its way, Greta Van Susteren will be talking about Natalie Holloway and Jeroen van der Sloot. Well, I suppose I'm oversimplifying. Maybe there will also be a new turn in the Anna Nicole Smith saga. Maybe they'll discover that she's still dead. If you'd like to get through to us, our call-in toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. That's 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach me through Facebook, Twitter, and questions at bobsiegel.net. I've got a couple of comments to read. Concerning Helen Thomas's comments about Israel, Robert says, I'd like to give her some slack for senility, but I can't. Concerning Obama and the oil spill, Maureen writes, I suspect that he purposely allowed the disaster to get as bad as possible. His tepid attempts to do anything indicate a willingness to make everyone suffer, because that's what Marxists do. Let the situation get so bad that when you sweep in with a government takeover, the people won't see that the cure is worse than the problem. I heard that 17 countries offered to help with the cleanup, and all were turned down but one or two. Now they're letting the oil wash up on the beaches, and it breaks your heart to see the birds, and from what I have seen, not an oil vacuuming tanker in sight. All that Obama, she calls him Obama, all that Obama knows how to do is blame and sue. He is clueless as to how to do anything else. And concerning blaming George Bush for the problems of the world, Robert writes, you forgot CBS blaming Bush for the Gore breakup. Now, that one I didn't know, Robert. As you know, Al Gore and his wife Tipper broke up recently on CBS. They were blaming George Bush for that because apparently they never got over Al losing in 2000. And then Maureen, not the same Maureen, a different Maureen. Did you know there's more than one Maureen that listens to the show? A lot of Maureens like the show. Different Maureen writes, I wonder what they will blame him for next. And Renee writes, wasn't he also responsible for the Mount Vesuvius eruption that destroyed Pompeii? Very good, Renee. Well, you are listening to The Bob Siegel Show, the theme, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. In our pop culture department, I am going to give you a review of the movie Robin Hood. Yes, another Robin Hood movie, and I'll review it for you when we return to The Bob Siegel Show. Good projects don't just happen. Good projects are a result of a team of dedicated professionals, owners, architects, and contractors striving toward a common goal. Make OMP a part of your team. If you're looking for professional, knowledgeable experience for your construction project team, Oso Miller Pacific should be your first call. For over 20 years, Mark Miller has been providing project management and constructive services throughout San Diego and Southern California. As president of Oso Miller Pacific, Mark continues this tradition of providing the most professional services in the industry to the healthcare, commercial, and government construction markets. Oso Miller Pacific provides a full range of pre-construction services, including definition of needs, design team selection, concept budget generation, and construction services. This full range of services is what sets Oso Miller Pacific apart from its competition. Visit their website at osomillerpacific.com. That's www.osomillerpacific.com or call the offices at 619-449-0633. Again, the number is 619-449-0633. Good projects don't just happen. Call Oso Miller Pacific. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Now, I got to tell you, I never cared much for the Robin Hood movies, which is somewhat of an anomaly for me. After all, I love heroic adventure cinema, especially period pieces with clearly drawn lines between good and evil. My heart also holds a special affection for beautiful English countryside. Yes, all the ingredients are there, but with Robin Hood, the cake never quite bakes to my satisfaction. With the exception of one Errol Flynn version from long ago, Robin Hood, for some reason, has never grabbed me. Even if it had, that horrible Kevin Costner portrayal ran the potential of killing poor Robbie's franchise for good. In any event, I did view the latest Robin Hood incarnation. Artistically, the film was impressive. With Russell Crowe and Cate Blanchett in the cast, one would expect first-rate action, and we were not disappointed. Unfortunately, the acting is a little too convincing as Robin Hood scolds Richard the Lionhearted for his crusade massacre of the poor Muslims. An extra ironic touch was added in that many of these Muslims were beheaded by the evil Christians, according to Robin Hood. Gotta see the irony of that one. Strong, vibrant pathos is added when Hood describes pity in the eyes of a Muslim woman for the godless murderers of her own people. So much for the eyewitness account of Robin Hood, that historically accurate chronicler of history. Now, admittedly, Christians do not have much to brag about as far as the Crusades are concerned. But those who want to absolve the Muslims of their own massacres are living in a dream world, or perhaps a modern university. Truth be told, Christians were taking back land stolen by Muslims on their jihads ordered by Muhammad. Still, any Christian theology that feels a need to expand territory for the sake of the gospel is waged in disobedience to the teachings of Jesus, who commanded his followers not to take up the sword. Muslims, on the other hand, were fighting in obedience to the words of Muhammad. I find that a significant difference. Had 9/11 not motivated Hollywood to lecture us about how peaceful Islam truly is, I wonder if Robin Hood's first-hand account of the Crusades might have been different. Political correctness and decent acting put aside, there is not much more to distinguish this film from other Robin Hood entries, with two notable exceptions. First, this is a kind of Robin Hood prequel in which we learn how the man and his mission were developed. Second, in all likelihood, Ridley Scott's latest fare will inspire the very first movie to be titled Robin Hood 2. Perhaps a more pertinent discussion is the fascination people still hold for this time-honored story. These days, those who believe in the evils of capitalism and mandatory redistribution of wealth are making frequent references to Robin Hood, claiming the hero is one of their own. In point of fact, we know very little about the real Robin Hood, except that he did exist and he did rebel against the king. But legendary as the man may be, we should at least relay the legend accurately. Robin Hood did not steal from the rich and give to the poor. Let me say it again. Robin Hood, according to the legend, did not steal from the rich and gave to the poor. He stole from the government after the government imposed unfair taxes on their citizens and he gave the money back to the people the government had swiped it from. That doesn't sound like a Marxist Robin Hood to me, but it does sound like somebody who I wish would run for office this November. No, he did not steal from the rich and give to the poor, but you may feel the theater stole your money if you go to this. Okay, 2 weeks ago, I began a very detailed discussion from the book of Daniel for people who claim that Bible prophecy is inaccurate. Daniel was a slave in Babylon, and the Babylonians were eventually taken over by the Persians. And Daniel gave this fantastic prediction in the 9th chapter. He predicted several things. He predicted that the Jews would be given permission to return to their own land, which was unheard of in those days. If that had been the only thing that happened, it would have been a miracle. But a lot more happened. He predicted that the temple would be rebuilt. He predicted the exact day that the Messiah would come and predicted that the Messiah would die. Well, this stuff happened. On March 5th, 444 BC, King Artaxerxes allowed the Jews to return and rebuild the city of Jerusalem. And if you count the exact number of days in Daniel, it takes you to March 25th, 33 AD, and 33 AD, March 25th, was the day Jesus Christ rode into Jerusalem. But we left off our discussion. When I say this, all this is assuming that we have these dates correct. If these are the correct dates, then the calendar works. But there are some people who try to claim that Jesus Christ was not executed in 33 AD. So how do we figure this? Well, I left off talking about the Hebrew calendar, and I want to read to you from the scholar H.W. Honer. I owe a great debt of gratitude to the research he's done. I want to read you this in his own words. Hebrew calendar was composed of 30 days each. He said the first day of the month commenced with the new moon. The new moon is not visible, but one or two days after the new moon, a faintly glowing moon sickle can be seen. When two trustworthy witnesses swore in an oath before the priestly calendar commission that they had seen the new moon, the day would be decreed the first of the new month. When there was a problem of visibility, the establishment of the new month could not be postponed for more than a day. Now, people, I'm no astronomer, but thank goodness others are. Because of new information from a variety of calendars, along with progress in astronomical knowledge, we can tell within minutes the new moon of the Jewish calendar at the time of Christ. Astronomers can actually know the days of the week on which Nisan 14, which it was according to the Persian calendar, which Nisan 14 fell in Christ's time, and they can know this with great probability. The candidates are AD 17, AD 30, AD 33, or AD 36. Astronomically, AD 17 is considered the least likely. Now, how do these possible years relate to the ministry of Christ? Luke chapter 3 says John's ministry started in Tiberius's 15th year, which was AD 28-29. Jesus' ministry followed, so it doesn't take a genius to see that the AD 27 date is not only doubtful astronomically, but impossible biblically. What about 36? Well, this would have given Jesus a ministry of more than 3 years. And there is evidence for a three-year ministry of Christ. Three Passovers are mentioned in John, making it at least a two-year mission, but the Synoptic Gospels mandate another year between the Passovers. Well, what about AD 30? The New Testament passion narratives paint Pontius Pilate as a man of conscience and weak backbone who wanted to please the Jews, but the ancient historian Josephus portrays him as a brutal dictator who massacred Jews and cared nothing for their cause. This is one of the reasons people say that the Gospels are not accurate historically, because they say this is not an accurate portrayal of Pontius Pilate. He looks like a real nice guy in the Gospels, and he was actually a brute. Well, to tell you the truth, the New Testament does not deny Pilate's brutality at all. In fact, Luke actually corroborates Josephus. I'm reading from Luke chapter 13, verse 1. Now there were some present at that time who told Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. That doesn't sound like a very nice guy, mixing human blood with animal sacrifices. Even the passion narratives show us a man who condemned Jesus to death, despite the fact that he found no guilt in the man. That is hardly a glowing testimonial. And remember also that Pilate had Jesus tortured before he was executed. So he's not portrayed as a nice guy at all. Still, how do we account for Pilate's fear in the Gospels? We definitely see fear. He seems less like a dictator, more like a politician. He seems to be putting Jesus to death to please the Jews. Doesn't that contradict his previous behavior? By the way, when I say things like please the Jews, don't bother writing me telling me that that's an anti-Semitic comment. First of all, I'm Jewish, as a lot of you know. So you're listening to a Jew. But at the same time, who wrote these passion narratives? Who wrote the Gospels? Who's giving us the report of what the Jews did? The Jews are. They're being obvious. It was the Romans who executed Christ, but the Jewish Sanhedrin had something to do with it. And yet the Jewish populace loved Jesus. We'll get back to this mixed bag and explaining Pilate's behavior, which can authenticate the AD 33 date, which can authenticate the Daniel calendar when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's daily blog on townhall.com. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net.
This is Bob Siegel inviting you to tune in for the Rick Amato Show four nights a week here on 1170 KCBQ. Rick stays on top of the issues local and national. He also does some of the most stimulating interviews you've ever heard. That's the Rick Amato Show, Monday through Thursdays from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. here on Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. You can also find Rick on AmatoTalk.com.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Welcome back to our program. Since history paints Pontius Pilate as a pretty evil person who hated the Jews, how do we account for the fact that he was so hesitant to destroy Jesus Christ? Well, this obvious change of attitude is easily explained when we supply an important missing piece of the puzzle. Before Pilate's encounter with Jesus, he had another encounter, a not-so-pleasant encounter with Emperor Tiberius, and this ruler of Rome actually brought Pilate's anti-Jewish policies to a screeching halt. Among his other unpopular practices, Pilate had erected some Roman shields at his Jerusalem palace, and these shields bore pagan inscriptions, offensive to the Jews. Four prominent Jewish princes represented their people by writing a letter to the emperor after pleading in vain to the stubborn governor of Judea to have them removed. Tiberius responded sharply with a letter of his own and demanded that Pilate remove those shields at once. And we can read about that from the ancient historian Philo. Now, decide for yourself if Pilate's political back and forth persona makes more sense. He has been rebuked by the emperor for his treatment of the Jews. Out of the blue, Jesus is thrown his way, and as governor, it is his decision alone to convict or acquit. Out of fear, he now wants to please the Jews. Okay? Emperor Tiberius says, you better be nice to the Jews. So now he wants to please the Jews. But which Jews? The Jews are divided. Does he please the Jewish leaders and representatives of the Jewish court who want Jesus dead but cannot legally execute him themselves? Or does he please the many followers of this very popular Jesus person? At first, Pilate seemed to be catering to the people at large, but that changed when the Sanhedrin, the Jewish court, played its final wild card. And I'm reading from John 19:12. From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, but the Jews kept shouting, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." Caesar, of course, was the nickname that they gave to all emperors, including Emperor Tiberius. Okay, could Pilate, after already finding himself on the bad side of Caesar, ignore these words about opposing Caesar? Now, what caused Emperor Tiberius to be so lenient with the Jews? You wouldn't think a Roman emperor would be lenient with the Jews. Didn't happen very often. Quick history crash course. A very wicked man named Sejanus ruled at the time of Pilate. He had gained one of the highest positions available, called prefect of the Praetorian Guard. Now, when Tiberius the emperor retired, or semi-retired, he was still emperor, but he semi-retired to the island of Capri, Sejanus was in control of the government for all intents and purposes. Sejanus was an enthusiastic anti-Semite with ambitions to wipe out the Jewish race. Pilate seemed to be carrying out these anti-Jewish policies. At the very least, we know that the stuff Pilate did to the Jews wasn't forbidden by Sejanus. Sejanus would be delighted if he didn't order it himself. While Sejanus was in control, any Jewish petition for leniency, remember I said some princes sent a letter to Tiberius. I got to tell you, if Sejanus had been alive when they sent that letter, the letter never would have reached Capri. The letter never would have reached Tiberius. While Sejanus was in control, any Jewish petition would be destroyed long before it had a chance to get to the island. Sejanus had poisoned Tiberius's son Drufus, but he still had Tiberius eating out of his hand, believing him to be loyal as a son. Tiberius determined that Germanicus, a nephew, was next in line as emperor if anything happened to his son Drufus. But by an amazing, incredible coincidence, at the time Drufus was poisoned, Germanicus was also found dead. One of his sons could now take the throne if only they would live, but with Sejanus around, that was no easy task. He eliminated two of the three sons. Only one son remained, Gaius. Well, it had to happen sooner or later. Tiberius finally began to smell a rat. He appointed Marco as prefect of the Praetorian Guard and sent him to Rome with orders to get rid of Sejanus. Marco tricked Sejanus by telling him Tiberius was going to grant him the Tribucana Protestus, which meant supreme authority over Roman civil affairs. Marco timed it all perfectly. A flattered and excited Sejanus rushed to the Senate floor, a Senate that had been made wise as to what was going on. A letter from Tiberius was read in the Senate just as Sejanus entered. In this letter, Sejanus was renounced and condemned. This happened on October 18th, AD 31. And this is very important. AD 31, Sejanus is executed. After this, Tiberius, obviously concluding that Sejanus had colored his thinking about the Jews. After this, Tiberian lightens up on the Jews. All of this to say that Jesus' trial must have taken place after the death of Sejanus, because while Sejanus was alive, Pilate wouldn't be worried about pleasing the Jews. We cannot explain the change in Pilate's behavior any other way. We can now throw out the AD 30 date, and that leaves only AD 33. Christ rode into Jerusalem according to the Julian calendar on March 30th, 33 AD. King Artaxerxes decreed that the Jews could rebuild the city of Jerusalem on March 5th, 444 BC. From 444 BC to March 30th, 33 AD, Daniel gave the exact amount of days. And I went through all of this 2 weeks ago. It's still on my website if you want to hear all the details of how that calendar was calculated. When the days are counted, we see that Daniel was not only an accurate prophet, he predicted to the day Christ's arrival in Jerusalem as the promised Messiah. Well, I hope you found that as interesting as I did. I found that stuff absolutely fascinating when I first looked at it. Now we're going to begin another discussion, and we'll only have a chance to just whet your appetite. So this discussion will conclude next week. I'm going to read to you an extremely controversial passage of Scripture. I'm reading from Matthew chapter 7, verse 13. Jesus talking, he says, "Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it." Okay, now a little bit of background. In those days, cities were surrounded with walls and entered through gates, some connected with great roads to the city, and some of these gates, therefore, were broad and could admit a crowd. Others were for private purposes. They were narrow and few could enter them. Now, Jesus is relating this to our eternal destiny, and he's making a very depressing point. Most people are going to hell. The Bible talks about heaven. The Bible talks about hell. Most people are going to hell. And when I say most, I just mean by comparison the amount of people going to hell. That doesn't mean there won't be all kinds of people in heaven. Revelation 7, 9 through 10 does tell us that there will be a lot of people in heaven. It says, "After this I looked, and there before me," this is John having a vision, "I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne in front of the Lamb. They were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands, and they cried out in a loud voice, 'Salvation belongs to our Lord who sits in the throne.'" Now, why is it that most people are going to end up in hell? Whoa, what a question to leave you with. Would I be cruel to leave you with that question? Yes, I would. But cruelty would not be my reason. Being radio savvy and leaving you wanting more would be part of my reason. And the fact that I'm just out of time and couldn't continue talking even if I wanted to might be my other reason. But count on this. I will continue that discussion. Why are most people going to end up in hell? Now, you tell me you don't believe a loving God would send people to hell? I'll throw that into the mix next week, too. I submit to you that if there were no hell, we could not have a loving God. The opposite is true. A loving God would send people to hell. What do you think about that? Well, tell me what you think about it next week. This is Bob Siegel, just making the obvious obvious.